Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Tonight on our program, I sit down with leaders of some of the Bay Area's religious institutions to discuss what they are doing to keep their organizations relevant and effective. The news for organized religion in recent years hasn't been rosy. A 2015 survey by the Pew Research Center of 35,000 Americans from all 50 states found that Americans increasingly identify as spiritual but not religious. The shift has been broad-based, not limited to any gender, ethnicity, age, education level, or political affiliation, though the group does skew young. For the Bay Area in particular, the shift away from organized religion has been dramatic. One-third of all the adults surveyed in San Francisco identified as atheist, agnostic, or unaffiliated, making San Francisco the second most religiously unaffiliated metro area in the nation. In case you're curious, we tied with Seattle, and Portland took the number one spot. This trend has not been lost on the leaders of San Francisco's congregations, and many of them are taking steps to address it. But with the skyrocketing cost of living pushing many out of the area, including families and immigrants who are often more likely to be religiously affiliated, will their efforts be successful? And how are their efforts to remain relevant affected by the increasing political polarization across our nation? As the problems facing our region and our country become more pressing, can and should our religious institutions be part of the conversation? Though religious differences have so often been the cause of strife, can the Bay Area's congregations unite to make progress? To discuss these issues and more, I'm pleased to be joined in the studio this evening by Abu Qadir Al-Amin, currently Imam of the San Francisco Muslim Community Center. Imam Al-Amin received his first appointment as resident imam in 1981 and served as Muslim chaplain at the federal prison in Dublin, California. Additionally, he worked for the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice as program director and associate director for 23 years and is actively involved with faith-based community organizing. Welcome, Imam Al-Amin.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Also joined this evening by Jason Rodich. He's rabbi with Congregation Emmanuel in San Francisco. Rabbi Rodich received his rabbinic ordination from Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion in Los Angeles. Prior to joining the clergy team at Emmanuel in 2015, Rabbi Rodich served as assistant rabbi and director of lifelong learning at Hir Tikva Congregation in Minneapolis. Welcome, Rabbi Rodich. You minced there. I didn't say that correctly, did I?
It's Shir Tikva. That's okay.
Shir Tikva. Thank you for
Hi. I'm very happy to be here.
Great.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And finally, we're joined by the very Reverend Dr. Malcolm Clemens Young, an Episcopal priest and Dean of Grace Cathedral. Dean Young began his tenure at the ninth Dean of Grace Cathedral in August of 2015. Prior to that, he served as rector of Christ Church in Los Altos, California, where he also founded Ventana School, an Episcopal day school. He is a moderator of The Forum, the cathedral's flagship lecture series, and has a regular column in the San Francisco Examiner. Welcome, Dean Young.
Great. Thanks. It's good to be here.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, and you can reach us then by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you want to contact us right away, you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or on our Facebook page, and you can also tweet us at CityVisions KALW. Do you think of yourself as spiritual but not religious? And if so, why? We want to hear your thoughts on this topic, so please reach out to us. But to get us started, I wanted to turn to each of our guests and ask you in turn, as religious leaders here in San Francisco, hearing what you just heard in the introduction, if you by those statistics, first of all, what is your take on the role and relevance of organized religion in the Bay Area specifically? Why don't we start with you, Imam Al-Amin?
Yes. I think my perception of the needs of young people as it relates to how they're involved in the organized faith of Islam at the mosques here, and there are about 7 mosques in San Francisco. And some of the activities at the mosque are not necessarily geared toward the young people. For example, our Friday prayer service, Jummah prayer, which is held midday on Fridays, many times our young people are at school, they're at work, In some cases, they're at schools far away from where the mosques are located, so it's not easy access for them. So one of the things that happens on some of the college campuses, like City College, San Francisco State, USF, the Muslim youth organize themselves, and they have their Friday prayer services on the campus. So it's not necessarily that they're not involved in organized religion. They're actually organizing themselves to meet the needs, their needs, where they are. And with Islam, for Prophet Muhammad, we're taught that the whole world is a place of worship. Everything except the graveyard and the bathroom. So you can have your worship service at school, in a business office, in a park, as long as it's clean. So it's a flexible kind of way that you can fulfill your obligation, your personal obligation, to making your daily prayers and things like that in a flexible way. And another thing that I've observed many times, the young people who may have traditionally grew up in a mosque, being taken there by their mothers and fathers, when they become young adults and on their own, they may still be involved, but they may not be worshiping where their parents are. One of the things that I've experienced is young people like to establish their own independence, not necessarily under the direction of people who raised them. They kind of go out on their own. And my experience is that young people are not leaving the religion of Islam. Many of them are coming to it.
And they're just worshiping in different spaces.
In different spaces, and they're developing their own relationship with the Creator that may be different from what their parents experienced. Some of their parents come from backgrounds where they may be from Egypt, they may be from West Africa, they may be from some of these locations where they're used to the religion being presented in a certain way. So it's a kind of like nostalgia for immigrants who come here, and they may want to have an imam who dresses like he's from Egypt, or they may want an imam that dresses like he's from Pakistan or from a culture that they're accustomed to. And then their children who grew up here, their needs and perceptions are a lot different. And so I know there's one organization in the East Bay, it's called Ta'alif Collective, and it's an organization of young Muslims who are looking for something different than the traditional nostalgic mosque.
Hmm. So, Rabbi Rodich, to you next. Again, as a religious leader here in San Francisco, what is your take on this perception that not only the Bay Area, but the rest of the country is becoming less religiously affiliated? And how does that raise challenges for you in keeping the relevance of the faith that you represent?
Sure. I think it's absolutely true. You can't deny that. And it's also totally not true. It depends on what story we're telling. There are congregations all over our country that are struggling. And there are also really bright spots, congregations that cannot that are bursting at the seams. Our congregation, Emmanuel, we have a monthly Shabbat service. Shabbat is our Sabbath for young adults, and we regularly get 200 to 300 people in our doors for these services. And I could tell you stories like that from places around the country. So I think the question is not, you know, why aren't people joining organized religion, but what works, because there actually are places that are vibrant and working and thriving right now. And I see no reason to believe that people still don't want and crave deep meaning in their lives, a sense of sacred community, a connection to something very ancient and powerful. But the truth is that across the board, I think many religious traditions in the United States kind of fell asleep at the wheel and forgot that at the core of this project has to be imagination and evolution and change. We live in a world that's radically changing right now. This is a moment of great instability. You could say that religion should be this constant, but I think that's false. That religion has to radically change and evolve with the world right now. I don't think any religious leader knows where it's going. But our obligation has to be to be open to the process, to the unfolding of where we are, and to meet not just our people, but the world where it's at, to imagine together what spirituality and religion might mean for the future. So again, I really believe that religion and spirituality, first of all, it's a false dichotomy. They're together, and they're not dying at all, but we have to reimagine and reanimate what religious life can mean.
So, Dean Young, how about this notion that in a time of turmoil, uncertainty, where religion could be a constant, could be a grounding place, that in fact it needs to be growing and adapting rather than just kind of standing firm?
You know, part of this is this is a much bigger thing than just what's happening in religion. Just people's participation, the way they participate in social groups is changing so much. So if you go to the opera or the symphony or play, I mean, and you look at the nearest Methodist church, I mean, it's the same crowd, you know, that's there so many times. So it's not just – and you know, part of the problem, too, is that the 1950s America, I mean, that was a high watermark of participation in religion in the history of the country. So more people as a percentage went to church in the 1950s than did in the 1930s, the 1920s, the 1880s, the 1850s, all the way back. So part of it is just adjusting to this situation, which is new. And like Jason said, if you just think you can just do the same things that you did in the past and have life and meaning for people, you're mistaken. We really need to meet people wherever they are, connect with who they are, and be involved in their lives. So, you know, one of the things that we have at Grace Cathedral, we have yoga on Tuesday nights, 6:15. It's open to everybody. You know, we'll have 500 people there, and the place is packed. Every single spot you can have a yoga mat has a yoga mat. Every single one of the sessions has a kind of spiritual message to start things off. The person who is the teacher of the yoga is a deeply spiritual person too. So we offer all sorts of different things for different people, and we're exploring those possibilities as they unfold.
So it sounds like, for lack of a better term, you need to market yourselves better in some way. That's not the way necessarily people think of organized religion, as kind of like going out there and trying to get people's attention. Now, granted, different faiths have missionary type work that's there to attract more believers, and others don't. But this notion of marketing, so to speak,
well, even that just describes it perfectly, because it's like we almost can't talk about anything out of the commercial business language. Mm-hmm. It's like it's so dominant. And really, the difference between now and the years before, it's how much people are working. You know, Juliette Shore is a sociologist. She's also my friend. She wrote the book, The Overworked American. She said, if you just add like 20-30 hours a week a year that you're working every year, it compounds until everybody's working so much they just don't have space to join the Elks Club or be in a bowling league or to join a church. So part of the problem is like we can't even conceive of human community outside of like paying money for a relationship. I'll go to the store and give you $3 and you'll give me a bunch of bananas. And it's almost like that relationship of buying something from somebody else, it's taken over everything.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. The economic reality, I think, determines to a large extent how much people participate in religious activities. Myself, growing up in Northern California, the only mosque in Northern California when I was a teenager, when I first embraced the faith, was in San Francisco. So there was no mosque 35 miles away where I lived. Now to expect people to drive 35 miles to come to the mosque, it's a phenomenon they call the commuter mosque. There was a time when the mosque was geared toward the people who lived in that particular neighborhood. Now with the population of San Francisco diminishing, with African Americans, so they've moved out of San Francisco. Not only African Americans, families, once people start having children, they can no longer afford to live in San Francisco, so they're moving to Fairfield, Vacaville, Suisun, Antioch, Pittsburgh. There was one congregation that we have some interfaith work with, San Francisco Christian Center. They lost so many congregants to the economic reality in San Francisco that they had to open 8 churches in the East Bay and San Jose. So that dynamic is hurting the population of Muslims in San Francisco because people can't afford to live here. And it's gaining a reputation of being family unfriendly.
Hmm. And Rabbi Rodish, what do you make of this the economic challenges, both in the way people connect these days, right, mm-hmm. on a very consumer level model, and the cost of living in this area, and how that's affecting your congregation, and how it grows or shifts, even if the numbers, let's say, are staying stable, perhaps the demographics are looking different.
Well, you can't deny that the economic reality of the Bay Area is hard on every organization and institution in the region, and we're not exempt from that at all. From everything from our congregants' ability to remain here in our congregants to our ability to pay our staff and all of it. At the same time, we have 2,300 families, 5,000 congregants. I'm here to say Emmanuel's amazing and that you should be like us, but I'm not. But I do believe that people really need something that we have to offer right now, and if you can find a way to do it, they will make room for it in their lives, even with their busy, busy, full lives, because we offer something that can be nurturing to a population that's weary from this very economy. That we have to put ourselves forward as the resistance to a world that wants to dehumanize us. And I see that on our people when they come in for a Friday night service and they can leave the week behind them. And, we have to do better marketing, as you say, but that also turns me off. Like Malcolm, I want to meet people outside of that context and be human together.
And so that sort of leads to my next question, which is being here in the center of the tech revolution, how do you feel that has, you've pointed to that a little bit already, but how do you feel that it's eroded some of your ability to connect with people and to draw people in? And perhaps do you see some solutions to drawing people in that actually, if you're talking about meeting people where they're at, right, if they're on their phones, how do you bring technology into your efforts to make what you have to offer seem enticing and relevant to people?
You know, in the 1990s, when the internet was first getting established, Grace Cathedral received a gift, a huge gift to basically start what we called GraceCom, which was, you know, the cathedral's presence on the web. And it was tremendously influential to be kind of that, have that opportunity to be a first mover in that setting. And now, I mean, those technologies that were so expensive in 1997 seem like they're free almost right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things we learned through all that is that there is, I mean, it's almost like what happens in a synagogue or a mosque or a church is almost like it's the antidote to your totally online life. Human beings, we receive so much gratification from scrolling through our cell phones and through our Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff. I mean, they're designed to be addictive to us. They're designed to just swallow us whole. And yet there's something really important about being a human being and being in community with other people. And that's what I think that these religious organizations in particular have to offer. You're not just on your own in your own head. You're somebody else is there to help you when you need help, to correct you when you might, you know, be going down the wrong path. Somebody who's paying attention to you, who's present for you. So I almost think that these religious life, we have to, you know, do a good job in terms of connecting with people technologically, but also what we have to do is offer kind of an antidote to technology.
Hmm. And what does that look like? Imam Al-Amin.
Yes, I think it can be helpful. Technology definitely is helpful for people who are shut in and maybe sick and maybe at a job where they can't get to the mosque. So if the services are live streamed, that's a benefit to the congregations that we serve. It doesn't replace a person actually attending and being in relationship with other family members and people. I think that's very important. But we have to reimagine the reality we're dealing with. Some of those things, we didn't create this new environment, the media culture and technology that's now dominating everybody's lives. We didn't create it as individuals. We're all reacting to it. So the generation that is going to be replacing some of us. I'm an older person, so I might have another 20 years on the planet if God is merciful to me. But they have to reimagine how do they figure that out themselves. And I'm not proposing that I have the answers, but some of our young people, what I've observed, we're real good at special events. We'll have special events and 500-600 young people show up and you're like, wow, where are they at? Outside of the special event. So, you know, these are some things that I think have to be discussed among the entire congregation, and we have to look at the impact that Uber and Lyft and all of this congestion that we're beginning to experience in the Bay Area. Sometimes we recently relocated our mosque from the Western Addition to the Excelsior District. So the people who used to be able to attend when we were in Western Addition, they said, well, Imam, I'd love to be at the Friday service, but I have to take off 3 hours. I can't afford to do that, you know. It's so much traffic, whereas before, you know, they come to a 40-minute service and they're back at work in an hour. Now that's impossible. So,
And why'd you move?
We got a larger place, mm-hmm. and we had lost the lease on the other place. And we're relatively new to the area. When I say new, we don't have properties that we own. We don't have funeral homes. We don't have schools that we own. We don't have mosques that we own. We have a few now in San Francisco. So we're pioneering. And many of the needs that other people may take for granted, you know, when you invite somebody to come to the mosque, you also invite them to help paint, help put down carpet. Okay, we need a new bathroom. So it's all of these other challenges, and everybody's not ready for that type of commitment. It's another level of commitment. You go to a Grace Cathedral, for example. It's been there for a long period of time.
It's
a well-established institution. It's a part of the landscape of San Francisco, and it's a different kind of reality that goes along with that. Now, the people who established that, we're still in the establishment phase of our development here in America. And that's a challenge. Everybody's not always up for the challenge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Rabbi Roditch, you said something earlier that you felt like organized religion was asleep at the wheel or fell asleep at the wheel. Say more about what you mean about that and how that relates to the conversation about how organized religion can continue to be relevant and meaningful in people's lives.
Right. Well, there was a long period of time in our country where people were joiners, right? And institutions could just count on families to be members, and things could kind of proceed along as they did and as they would. And, you know, one of the benefits of that, you know, of a competitive marketplace, dare I say, is that it can spark innovation. And that didn't exist. And I think that what we are seeing now is that we cannot take people's attendance and presence for granted. We actually have to work hard. We have to this phrase, meet them where they're at. I want to take it a step further. That we have to create opportunities for real spiritual depth and meaning that can help, that can offer people a religious life that is more than they could imagine on their own. It has to be more than what they can get at the yoga class on, you know, Friday morning at 6 a.m. before work, where they feel kind of spiritual. That we have to put forward that a community that can offer you a sense of belonging, but also a tradition of obligation, can actually make a difference in your lives and lives of your children and the life of our world. Can I also say something about the
Please.
Technology conversation?
Absolutely.
I want to say that I really like technology. And I think it would be a dangerous road for us to say that we are the antidote to technology right now. When I text one of my eighth graders and can connect with them in that way, that's that's something that religious leaders before me couldn't do. When I post to Facebook that we're having a Hanukkah party on Friday night in the mission, and we have over 300 Jews that we're expecting, young adult Jews that we're expecting to come, I'm able to organize community in a way that I could not before. You know, Judaism is a tradition of law, and it was designed to manage the technology in our lives, going back to ancient times. And so, you know, we can meet this amazing moment of human innovation that we are in with religious values and religious language and religious choices. And it can actually make our spiritual lives richer.
So when I hear more about that from each of you, and just again, how do you continue to shift and adapt and stay true to your core values and mission? But first, I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing religion in the Bay Area with Imam Abu Qadir Al-Amin, who is Imam of the San Francisco Muslim Community Center, Rabbi Jason Rodich with the Congregation Emmanuel in San Francisco, and Malcolm Young, Dean of San Francisco's Grace Cathedral. We invite you, our listeners, to join in with your questions and comments. Do you identify as spiritual but not religious? And if so, why? And if you've drifted away from organized religion, have you heard anything so far this evening that might draw you back? The toll-free number to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255, or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or on our Facebook page. You can also tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Let's go to our first caller, Karen from San Francisco. Karen, welcome to the program. Yeah.
Thank you. I wanted to comment on my journey in and out of spiritual but not religious. I was raised in a Christian church, a very kindly congregational Protestant church that was not traumatizing. I wasn't terrified of going to hell. But as I got older and when I started my own family, I completely fell away from organized religion. And me personally, I did what many of my friends have done, which is I turned Buddhism for sort of a more intellectual, experiential, personal inquiry into my own psyche and consciousness, and, you know, maybe not religious faith, but in an encounter with myself. But I have to say, after 25, and I have nothing but good things to say about the Buddhists that I have spent time with, and I think they're amazingly ethical, fantastic people. But I have to say that after 25 years out of the church, I felt this absence in my life. And in particular, when my middle daughter, one of her friends, jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, I knew I needed to be back in a religious community, not just thinking about ethics and religion, but I needed to be back with people who could support me and who had ideas about faith. And I made my way back to the Episcopal Church in Sausalito in Marin County. And it's been a kind of an extraordinary journey back to find that in our own Western traditions, we have a lot of the same things that many of us went to Buddhism and less theological, you know, religious but not spiritual, spiritual but not religious traditions for. You know, we have centering prayer, we have meditation, we have contemplation, and we also have the extraordinary support of beautiful communities of people who are helping each other through very difficult times, sharing, and just the beauty of the liturgy. Every week to get down on your knees, ask forgiveness for what you haven't done well, give thanks for what has gone well, pray for other people who are in trouble, and extend a hand has been extremely meaningful for me.
Thank you for sharing that personal journey of yours. I wanted to ask you, so have you disconnected from your Buddhist traditions and from those people, or do you have you found an amalgam in your current practice?
Definitely an amalgam, and I have a hard time saying whether I'm a Buddhist Christian or a Christian Buddhist. I usually settle on Buddhist Christian, but definitely I've integrated both. And I love Buddhists because they don't bear you any ill will if you don't believe any particular thing. You don't even have to believe God to be a Buddhist.
And how about your daughter? You mentioned your daughter. How has she responded to this shift?
You know, it's interesting. I'm 65 years old, and so I'm a total boomer generation, and I didn't raise my kids religiously, and it's one of the few regrets I have about how I raised them. So they don't have any context for it, and I don't want to say they're amused by it, but they have not come along in my reentry because they never got the entry point. So I think it's something that people raising children really need to think about. And I think the Jewish tradition does it very well. You can treat it as a tradition instead of a theology, if that's how you want to look at it.
And one more question before I let you go. If you hadn't had this moment of crisis in your life that you talk about, do you think you would have taken this step?
You know, I don't think I would have. I will say it's very personal, but it was when I wrapped my arms around the mother of this child who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, and I didn't know what to say to her. And all I could say to her is, you know, angels caught your child. And I was like thinking in my intellectual mind, why did I say that? I don't even believe in angels. But I really needed to have the safety net of belief that there is purpose to life, that it's not all Jean-Paul Sartre and existentialism and, you know, we're here and then we're gone. And it was hard for me because my husband is a scientist. He's an extremely ethical guy, but he doesn't have this kind of faith, and I found that I needed it.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us.
Okay, thanks for the program.
Yes. So how would you respond to what you heard from Karen?
You know, I just since the election last year, I've just run across so many people who, I mean, their daughter's friend jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, that's just so horrifying. But sometimes it just doesn't take something that dramatic in order to have somebody to hear that call, of the call to go back to their spiritual community. So I've definitely felt like people I've talked to since the election felt isolated, felt like powerless, felt like their voice didn't matter, and have come to religious communities to be with other people and to have their voice count again.
I want to hold up something that Karen really spoke to, which is this this tension between the individual and the communal. And I think especially in San Francisco and in the Western U.S., we are just wired. You know, so many people came here to get away from community, get away from things, right? It's in the DNA of this place. And but I think, it doesn't take necessarily a crisis like that to discover that there are moments when you really need other people. And to create community in the context of the sacred is a powerful experience. I don't want us to say that we only come to religion for community, though, right? That and I don't think Karen was saying that. But to be careful about that we do come for the purpose of religious practice, of spiritual development, of a sacred life of meaning. But the community is a huge, important piece of that.
What did you make of Karen's comment about the Jewish faith, about you could approach it as a tradition as opposed to a religion? I don't know if I said it exactly the way she did, but what did you take from that?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think what she's saying could actually be said about a lot of religions. You know, what does the word religion mean? And in some ways, it's an English word that describes some kinds of Christianity well, but that most people in the world, right, don't have a separation between their spiritual life and their heritage and their culture and their language and their food. It's all mixed up. That's true for lots and lots of peoples in the world, and it's true for Jews. And so there's lots of access points to our tradition, and whether or not someone calls that religious that's a newer question. It's a Western question for us. You know what I mean? It's not. I don't think that's a native question to Judaism, because we don't internally make those distinctions so well.
Mm-hmm. And you also earlier on said that you felt like the separation between spirituality and religiosity, or being spiritual and being religious, was a false one. Say more about what you meant there.
Well, what's this religion you're not a part of when you're spiritual? You know, I want to interrogate that. And then what is spirituality? If spirituality is something that makes you feel good and helps you find peace, okay, that's good. I want us all to have that. God knows this world is hectic and crazy. But I think we can do better than a kind of what a colleague of mine calls a spiritual jacuzzi. You know, that actually we are craving obligation, real deep meaning, and then answers to the big questions, right? What's it all about? Why am I here? Why do terrible things happen? How do I respond to the terrible things. What happens after I die? Who are we? Why am I here? All of that. So, you know, those are deeply spiritual questions, and the world's religions have been wrestling with those questions since ancient times. You can connect to these ancient traditions in your search for those answers. And, you know, there's this fear, I think, that you're going to have a kind of dogma shoved down your throat. And in most places, I think that's not actually true, that the ancient traditions, the ancient religions of the world are at their heart places of awe and wonder, where we explore these questions and try to create, again, community around them.
Imam Al-Amin, you were nodding there quite a bit while Rabbi Rodich was speaking, especially when he talked about how for many religions, you know, the day-to-day life and faith and practice and customs are all kind of mixed together. What resonated for you?
Well, it was as though he was describing Islamic faith, because our faith is comprehensive. It's not just what we do at the mosque. It's our entire life. It's how we live, our ethical behavior, how we interact with other human beings. It's about our study and our practice. It's the whole life of the human being, the spiritual life, the social responsibilities that we have to our neighbors and to our city and to the world that we all belong to. We all have a shared responsibility in this. So when he talked about that, it connected with me on a deep level, because that's how we approach our life. And it's not compartmentalized. And one of the trends that I think has happened in, I'll say, since the 80s, is that people don't want any authority in their life. People just want to kind of like do whatever they want to do, however they want to do it, whenever they want to do it. And they don't want to conform to any structures. And religion does give us a body of knowledge and that causes us to want to be more responsible. So people who stay away from it, they want to remain unregulated to some degree. And that's a trend that I believe gained great popularity in the 80s. And now people are finding a need for answers to some of those deep questions of like life and death matters. I've had to deal with counsel people who are sometimes faced with people who have tried to take their own life, and they feel like they could have saved them, or they wish they would have been present. They could have, and you know, in some cases, you might be able to save someone. Sometimes you can't. So those are things that are beyond our ability to manage. So we entrust those things to God. And I think that satisfies a great number of people, that we don't have to have all of the answers. We don't know everything. And faith plays an important part in that. And that gives the soul some levels of comfort that you don't get otherwise.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing religion in the Bay Area with Imam Abu Qadir Al-Amin, Imam of the San Francisco Muslim Community Center, Rabbi Jason Rodich with Congregation Emmanuel in San Francisco, and Malcolm Young, Dean of San Francisco's Grace Cathedral. We invite you again to call in with your questions and comments. Do you think religious organizations can or should play a role in addressing our region and nations' problems? We're going to get to politics next, by the way. Beware. The toll-free number to dial is, to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or on our Facebook page. You can also tweet us by using the hashtag cityvisionsKALW. So a couple of things there that I wanted to get back to. One thing that Karen said is, you know, she didn't have a traumatic experience being in a religious community as a child. But there's a lot of people who did. And some of that comes from some of the messages they got that who they were or what they believed was not acceptable, or they weren't included. How much of what we're seeing is response to some of that, of people falling away because they felt like, you know, they don't want me, I don't want them?
You know, in the 1990s, I think Grace Cathedral's approach was to really reach out to people who had that experience, who had been rejected because of their sexuality, rejected because of their theology, their view, because of their race, because of their opinions of the Vietnam War or whatever it was. And that really was a huge focus of our message. And now the people we're seeing, it's not like they were alienated by religion. It's like we're seeing Karen's children who just had no experience of religion at all. So it's not like they had a terrible experience they've got to overcome. They don't even know what the Lord's Prayer is. You know, they don't know, you know, who Moses is. I mean, I remember preaching a sermon once and someone came up to me afterward and said, "Wow, you know, you just quoted a Bob Marley song." And I thought, wow, you know, that is the Bible that Bob Marley was quoting. Bob Marley, when he was a little acolyte in an Anglican church when he was growing up. So that's what I'm finding more. It's not people who've been damaged by religion as much as people who just don't know what it's about. They don't know that this is and that's what I was thinking as Jason was talking. It's people they get their opinion of what churches or mosques or synagogues are like from TV and movies. They haven't been in one before. I mean, and so as people begin to have their own firsthand knowledge, they do see, just as Jason said, that it's no one's trying to impose a theological doctrine on you or shove something down your throat that you're not likely to believe, or the things that you find hard to believe, we find hard to believe too. I mean, helping people to see this possibility of what a religious tradition can mean, what an obligation to God might mean, what it means to step into this tradition that's ancient, that gives us a sense of grounding in a tough setting.
When so much is said about how organized religion doesn't have that space to be inclusive, how do you respond to that?
I want to respond to the first part of your question where you were saying people having bad experiences with organized religion. Organized religion is organized by people, and people have their strengths and they have their weaknesses. As a practicing Muslim, I visit a lot of places that are mosques all over the country, and I've been fortunate to travel around the world. Everything that goes on there is not necessarily grounded in the scripture of the Islamic faith, the Quran, nor is it the tradition that was established by the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, upon him be peace. So people may have bad experiences, and it may turn them off. That's one of the challenges that we have to do, is we have to make our religious tradition and our experience at the mosque and what we're trying to develop here in America be in accord with the revealed religion, not necessarily what the cultural practices are, because those vary from city to city and sometimes country to country. So you may have some bad experiences, but don't judge the religion by the people. Judge the religion by the book. I was reading about the study. It was a study that was a link that was sent out about this program. And one of the Muslims in that particular study, he said one of the things that he rejected about the religion was this myth about Abraham's son being turned into a goat, where Abraham was told to sacrifice his son, and then instead of sacrificing his son, the son was turned into a goat, and he sacrificed a goat. But that's not our religion at all. Whoever told him that gave him some misinformation. So the judgment was based on some information that wasn't true. So I think people should have first-hand knowledge in the religion of Islam. Muslims are required to have enough knowledge to practice the religion individually, without an imam, without anybody else. They have what we have a field of study called Fard Ayn. That's your personal duties. Then there's Fard Kifaya. That's community responsibility. Building a hospital may be a community responsibility. That's not your individual responsibility. Building a school is a community responsibility. Getting knowledge is your personal responsibility. So there's this balance. In some cases, people who are promoting the religion are not necessarily trained to do that. So people will have bad experiences.
Rabbi Norodich.
I'm a rabbi and I'm also a gay man. And I'm a gay man who has my feet firmly planted in the LGBT community. It's a very important part of my life. And I think we have to acknowledge that people have been spiritually terrorized by some of their religious experiences. There are people walking around with a lot of pain. And that pain is still being inflicted today by the religious right of this country. And so I think it's all the more important that those of us who try to hold down the space of a progressive, open, religious tradition from all traditions be louder and reclaim what it is to be religious. That's part of why I want to use that word and not say spiritual, because it's been co-opted by fundamentalism in so much of American discourse. But it doesn't have to be that way. And that there are religious traditions, religious communities, and religious leaders who see it as our religious obligation, our religious work on this planet, to reject that kind of violence and to help people heal from that kind of pain. And I see it personally in the work I do with my close friends. You know, like, being a gay rabbi, I'm able to sort of live that contradiction out and to demonstrate that that those who spread hate in the name of religion don't have ownership over all religious discourse in our society.
Let me put that phone number out again if you want to join our conversation. That's 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, as we discuss religion in the Bay Area with three religious leaders here, Imam Qadir, Abu Qadir Al-Amin of San Francisco Muslim Community Center, Jason Rodich, a rabbi with the Congregation Emmanuel in San Francisco, and Malcolm Young, Dean of San Francisco's Grace Cathedral. Let's go to Johnny from San Francisco. Johnny, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, thanks. Yeah, I just wanted a couple things. I did want to say I just happened to tune in. I do appreciate the struggles and the perspectives of the three religious guys that you have there, and I do appreciate your attempts to try to have a more open and a more progressive sort of religion. But I did want to say I think one of the reasons why a number of people claim spiritual but not religious is because if we're analyze history correctly, and even looking around the world today, even this most recent incident in New York, it has been that traditionally the clerics, the rabbis, the Islamic mullahs have in fact used religion as a means of essentially dominating people and abusing power and acting in ways that may contradict some of their own traditions, but nonetheless have become entrenched power brokers and power mongers. And I think that's why a lot of people are attracted to the Kabbalah, or are attracted to the Sufi tradition, or are attracted to the Christian mystical tradition, exactly because there isn't an intercession or a power mongering fellow human between the believer and God, or the seeker and God.
Thanks so much, Johnny, for your comments. I want to bring in Colleen next. Colleen, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Pacifica.
Okay, Colleen. Welcome to the program. Go ahead with your comment.
Thank you. It's a very interesting program, and this is the subject that I have considered a lot. I was raised Catholic, parochial schools, took a decade off to explore, and came back to Catholicism. But what I feel is something that is true of many religious, institutional religious organizations, is that there is a temptation to begin to identify religion with the institutional priorities. And that I see, not all, and I cannot speak to Imam Al-Amin's, I have had very little experience with the mosque environment, but I can say that I feel that large religious institutions spend quite a lot of time identifying themselves in opposition to, on theological points, arguments that go on over centuries. But that in essence, what many of them end up being are a type of bunker. And in sadly, often there is a very subtle caste system within the institutions, because there is a hierarchical distribution of influence, a dissemination of information, the authority. And I feel that speaking to Christianity, and I would say also inclusive of the Jewish faith, I mean, I look at the fact that Jesus was a Jew, and he stood upon the messages of Scripture, and that what he did in establishing what is now known as Christianity was to take those tenets on the road. He did not hide himself in luxury, in marble walls. He did not create an exclusive environment around himself, and quite the opposite, created a gravitational pull of insularity where all were welcome at all times. And he did not expect people to come to him. He went to them.
Colleen, I really appreciate your very eloquent comments. I want to make sure our guests get a chance to comment on your comments. So I'm going to have you take leave there, and thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you for this program. Thank you.
Something that that Colleen said there made me think of, you know, it's hate the sin but not the sinner. It's like hate the institution but not the faith is kind of what she was talking about, sort of what the institutions that have been built around these faiths have become or have been perhaps for a long time is what's really problematic for some people. But there was a lot there, more there than that, what Colleen said. So your comments. Let's start with you, Dean Young.
You know, part of what she says just reminds me just how individual all of our experiences are. So, I mean, just even when we were waiting in the green room before coming in here, we just talked about our different paths. And, I mean, they're so different. You know, to have a man whose father was in the military, traveling around, growing up in Vallejo, another growing up and coming to consciousness as a gay man in Minneapolis. I mean, in what your path is, the path that you've been on has a huge influence in terms of what you think is the problem with religion. You know, so, you know, in the Roman Catholics, I know, feel like the religion's been too much in the, you know, dictating too much, forcing them to think things. And for me, I just wanted the church to give me some direction. You know, I mean, the church didn't even tell me. I mean, it told me that racism was wrong and that women should be treated equally. But I mean, it didn't give me a lot of other direction. I wanted more. I wanted to know what the obligation was. So, I mean, it's a reminder to me that you know, we all have very, very different experiences of, you know, of church and faith, and it's not just all Southern Baptists and Alabama telling you who to vote for. It's a much richer, more complicated picture, and that's part of what I appreciate about today. Our colleagues on here are two men I just admire immensely, and when we were saying earlier that we hear each other's stories just in such different contexts.
But you were able to find a place in that organized institution.
Yeah,
and some people haven't.
Yeah.
And so
was,
I think that's what I'm, yeah. I wanted to hear your response to,
it was almost,
to some of the callers,
yeah,
about that I mean, concern.
Right. I mean, so it was almost that I felt like the institution, it needed help. And so, I mean, I've said, I don't know. I feel like my prospects in life in terms of what my income is, et cetera. I mean, I would have made a lot more money in another career. It's like being able to give your life to something that really matters. And I remember being in my 20s just saying, you know, I want to make a difference in the world. I want to do something that matters. And, you know, I have visited people in prisons and in hospitals, and it's been an enormous gift. on the ground to be visiting somebody, you know, whose daughter had just overdosed and who was on a life support system, and to be able to be with the family in that setting. I mean, there's like a lot of care that's going on that's just not part of our conversation of people who are lonely in prison, whose only visit is from an imam from San Francisco, who are in nursing homes, and the only person they see are nuns who come to visit them. And that's a little bit what we're missing in this whole conversation, is just on the ground, there's just a lot that our religious people are doing that have nothing to do with, you know, with the institutional loyalties, but is about just human care.
But how can people directly connect to that when there are these barriers people perceive of the institution?
Well, let me say this, that the way the mosque is perceived today is in part because of the global struggle that you find Muslims in all over the earth that are struggling with forces that came from outside of their community. You know, Syria has been destabilized, Iraq has been destabilized, Afghanistan has been... All of these countries are victims of some sort of colonial powers and multinational corporations and military-industrial complex. So when I came to Islam, I came to Islam out of a traditional struggle. I'm an African-American struggling for my rights as a full citizen in the United States of America. And my mother was of the Christian faith. My father didn't claim any faith. I didn't see the Christian church addressing my needs as a young person. So I was influenced by individuals like Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad, and later Imam Debuddin Muhammad. So it was a hopeful experience that I came into. When I came into the mosque, I came into the mosque seeking transformation for myself, seeking identity, seeking purpose, seeking guidance for establishing my family and how do I navigate through this minefield we call America. You know, I've experienced the criminal justice system. I've experienced police brutality. I've experienced discrimination in the education and all of those kind of challenges that some of our young people are facing today. But I've done it as a, you know, the playing field's a little different. I didn't get killed by the police, but I got beat by the police. So Islam has come as a salvation for some and gave us a methodology for how to live our life in America and realize the best of it while avoiding alcohol, drugs, promiscuity, lifestyles of crime, and things like that. So for many of us, the institution was also a place where we could rebuild our lives. And
we have less than a minute, Rabbi Roditz. You're going to get the last word, and we didn't even get to politics. So how do you bring this together? Those people who are feeling like they don't like the institutions, they have been abusive of their power and exclusive, and then yet there's this richness that you all talk about of what brought you to the work you do.
Look, I think that power and corruption and abuse are a part of human legacy, and they are all over human society. Religion is not exempt from them. At the same time, institutions are just institutions. They're just ways of bringing people together. And I don't want to live in a world that doesn't have ways of bringing people together. So we have to come together to create the kind of spiritual community and space for, you know, for that person whose daughter jumped off the bridge, to us to celebrate the most joyous moments in our lives. There will be problems sometimes, but my challenge to people is to... take a deep breath and join us in the project of building something better. It's not going to be perfect. Don't go on the hunt for it. It doesn't exist. Work with us to make what we have even stronger.
Well, I want to thank my guests, Imam Abu Qadir Al-Amin of San Francisco's Muslim Community Center, Rabbi Jason Roditz of the Congregation Emmanuel in San Francisco, and Malcolm Young, Dean of San Francisco's Grace Cathedral. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll have you back because we got to have that political conversation. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. Join me next Monday as we look at how California is trying to address the skyrocketing cost of prescription drugs. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.